Fish of the day is grilled tuna livornaise, asparagus, and roasted potatoes. Does anyone need livornaise explained again? The meat special is roast pheasant with port wine sauce and braised red cabbage. There are faux filet for two available. That's a big hip end piece off the sirloin strip, carved tableside for $50. Dessert special is tarte tatin. It's not too bad a lineup on the floor today. Doogie Howser, Morgan, the part-time underwear model, Ken, the veteran, who has a maniacal laugh you can hear out on the street. He's everyone's first choice for waiter most likely to snap, shave his head, climb a tower, and start shooting strangers. And some new waiter, the one who doesn't know what prosciutto is. I haven't bothered to learn his name, as I suspect he will not remain with us for long. There are two busboys, a taciturn workaholic from Portugal, and a lazy-ass Bengali. They should balance out, as usual. My runner today is the awesome Mohammed, nicknamed Cachundo by the kitchen. The best we have. I'm lucky to have him, as it looks like it's going to be busy, and the other runner, let's call him Osman, tends to lose it when things get hectic, and has an annoyingly sibilant way of pronouncing the letter S, making his calls for muscles, meat specials, and calves' liver particularly painful to hear when you're under fire. Cachundo immediately begins picking chervil tops, arranging garnishes, filling small crocks with grated Parmesan, harissa sauce, rosemary and thyme, gaufret potato chips, and picking out my favorite saucing spoons from the silver bins. At various times during my labors, I managed to conduct two clandestine meetings out on the street, agent reports on the activities of the previous night after my departure. I'm investigating the grill man incident from the manager's log, nothing earth-shaking. I have another brief encounter near the liquor room with someone who gives me the latest gossip from our Miami store and a rundown of latest developments at Le Marais, our sister restaurant on 47th Street, as well as some speculation about imminent moves by upper management and ownership. Again, nothing I don't know or assume already. I like my bosses and think they like me, so it's really only curiosity, not paranoia, that keeps me collecting and analyzing information from our distant outposts and conference rooms. Also, I like to hear different accounts of the same incident from different sources. It adds perspective and reveals sometimes what a particular source is leaving out or skewing to leave a particular impression, making me wonder why. I like to tell selected people things in supposed confidence a few times a week, for fun. Later, when it comes back to me, it provides an interesting roadmap of data transfer, a barium meal revealing who squeals and to whom. There are a number of interesting variations on this practice. Feeding false information to a known loudmouth, for instance, with a particular target in mind. A lot of what I hear is utterly useless, untrue, and uninteresting, but I like to keep myself informed. You never know what might prove useful later. 12 noon and already customers are pouring in. I get a quick kick in the crotch right away, an order for pork mignon, two boudin, a liver, and a pheasant all on one table. The boudin take the longest, so they have to go in the oven right away. First, I prick their skins with a cocktail fork so they don't explode. Grab a fistful of caramelized apple sections and throw them in a sauté pan with some whole butter for finishing later. I heat a pan with butter and oil for the pork, fling a thick slab of calf's liver into a pan of flour after salting and peppering it, heat another sauté pan with butter and oil for that. While the pans are heating, I take half a pheasant off the bone and lay it on a sizzle platter for the oven, spinning round to fill a small saucepan with the port sauce to reduce. Pan's ready, I sear the pork, sauté the liver. The pork goes straight into the oven on another sizzler. The hot pan I degrease, deglaze with wine and stock, add pork sauce, a few garlic confit, and put aside to finish reducing and mounting later. The liver half-cooked I put aside on another sizzler. I sauté some chopped shallots, deglaze the pan with red wine vinegar, give it a shot of demi-glace, season it, and put that aside too. An order for mussels comes in, with a breast of duck order right after. I throw on another pan for the duck, load a cold pan with mussels, tomato coulis, garlic shallots, white wine, and seasoning. The mussels will get cooked a la minute and finished with butter and parsley. More orders come in. It's getting to be full-tilt boogie time. Another pheasant, more pork, another liver, and ouch, a navarin. A one-pot wonder, but requiring a lot of digging around in my lowboy for all the garnishes. The key to staying ahead on a busy station is moving on a dish as soon as its name is out of Cachundo's mouth. Setting up the pan, doing the pre-searing, getting it into the oven quickly, making the initial move so that later, when the whole board is fluttering with dupes, I can still tell what I have working and what I have waiting without having to read the actual tickets again. Ready on 12, says Carlos, who's already got a load of steaks and chops and a few tunas coming up. He wants to know if I'm close on my end. Let's go on 12, I say. Miguel starts dunking spuds. I call for mashed potatoes for the boudin from Omar, give the apples a few tosses over flame, heat and mount my liver sauce, pull the pork mignon from the oven and clip off the strings that hold them together. Heat potatoes and veg for the pheasant, squeeze the sauce for the pheasant between pots onto a back burner, move the mussels off the heat and into a ready bowl, calling Papa Frita para Concha Negra to Miguel, as I spin and bend to check my duck breasts. Sauce pot with duck sauce and quince. I'll heat those right in the sauce. No room now. The orders are really coming in. The printer chattering away nonstop. I'm sneaking peeks at the dupes while they're still coming off the printer, trying to pick out what I'll be needing, like a base runner stealing signals. The intercom buzzes, and I pick up annoyed. Line one for the chef, says the hostess. I push the blinking green light. It's a salesman, wanting to sell me smoked fish. I answer all sweetness and light, lulling him into the bear trap in the Bigfoot style. So, let me get this straight, I say after he's jabbered away about his full line of delicacies, me trying to sound a little slow and confused. You want to sell me food, right? Yes, comes the reply, the salesman sounding encouraged by my interest and apparent stupidity. And in general, you'd say, I continue, you have, like, a lot of restaurant accounts. In fact, you'd probably say that, like, you're in the business of servicing restaurants, and chefs in particular? Oh, yes, says the witless salesman, beginning a litany of the usual prestigious accounts, the names of other chefs who buy his fine smoked sturgeon, salmon, trout, and fish eggs. I've had enough and cut him off cold. So what the fuck are you doing calling me in the middle of the fucking lunch rush? I scream into the phone, smashing it abruptly into the cradle. I catch the duck just in time, roll it over skin side down again, and pull it out of the oven. I've got a filet poivre on order, not on the regular lunch menu, but it's a steady customer, says Cachundo, and I'm set up for it anyway, so I start searing one off. Another pasta. I pour extra virgin into a pan and saute some paper-thin garlic slices with some crushed red pepper, add the artichoke hearts, roasted vegetables, some olives. I don't know why, but I always start humming Tony Bennett or Dino. Today it's Ain't That a Kick in the Head when I'm cooking pasta. I like cooking pasta. Maybe it's that I always wanted to be Italian-American in some dark part of my soul. Maybe I get off on that final squirt of emulsifying extra virgin just after the basil goes in. I don't know. More pork mignon. The runner calls down to Janine, who's making clafouti batter at her workstation in the cellar, and she comes running up to plate desserts. We're doing well so far. I'm keeping up with the grill, which is a faster station, unless the table orders a cote de boeuf or a faux filet for two or a whole roasted fish, which slows the order down. Omar is up to date with the appetizers, and I'm actually feeling pretty good, right in the zone. No matter what comes in or how much of it, my hands are landing in the right places, my moves are still sharp, and my station still looks clean and organized. I'm feeling fine, putting a little English on the plates when I spin them into the window, exchanging cracks with Carlos, finding time to chide Doogie Howser for slipping that filet poivre by me without checking first. Doogie, you syphilitic, white bread, mayonnaise-eating, John Tesh-ass wannabe, next time you slip a special order in without checking me first, me and Carlos gonna punch two holes in your neck and bump dicks in the middle. Doogie cringes, laughs nervously, and scurries out to the floor, trailing muttered apologies. Chef, says Omar, looking guilty, no mas tomates. My jaw drops, and I see white. I ordered tomatoes. I had thought the tomatoes had arrived. Then I remember I broke up the order between three companies. I call Segundo on the intercom, telling him to come up ahorita. I'm also furious with Omar for waiting until we're out of tomatoes to tell me there are no more. What the fuck is going on? I ask Segundo, who slouches in the doorway like a convict in the exercise yard. No Baldor, he says, causing me to erupt in a blind, smoking rage. Baldor, though a superb produce purveyor, has been late twice in recent weeks, prompting me to make some very uncivil telephone calls to their people, and worse, forcing me to do business with another lesser company until they got the message and began delivering early. Now, with no tomatoes and no delivery and the rush building, I'm furious. I call Baldor and start screaming right away. What kind of glue-sniffing, crackhead mesomorphs you got working for you? You don't have an order for me? What? I called the shit in myself. I spoke to a human. I didn't leave it on the tape, and you're telling me you don't have my order? I get three fucking produce companies. Three, and it's always you that fucks me in the ass. I hang up, pull a few pans off the flame, load up some more mussels, sauce a duck, arrange a few pheasants, and check my clipboard. I'm in the middle of telling Cachundo to run across the street to Park Bistro and ask the chef there if we can borrow some tomatoes, when I see from my neat columns of checked-off items on my clipboard that, in fact, I ordered the tomatoes from another company, that I didn't order anything from Baldor. I have no time to feel bad about my mistake. That'll come later. After screaming at the blameless Baldor, my anger is gone, so when I call the guilty company, I can barely summon a serious tone. It turns out that my order has been routed to another restaurant. Layla instead of Leal. I make a mental note to refer to my restaurant as Les Halles in the future. The dispatcher at the guilty company apologizes for the mix-up, promises my order within the hour, and gives me $100 in credit. More ducks, more pheasant, lots of mussels, the relentless tidal wave of pork mignon. Finally, lunch begins to wind down. I enjoy a cigarette in the stairwell while Carlos continues drilling out steaks, chops, and paillards, nothing from my station. D'Artagnan arrives, my specialty purveyor, wearing foie gras, duck legs, and an unexpected treat, a 200-pound free-range pig, whole, which José, one of my masters, has ordered for use in pâtés and tête de porc by the charcutier. Now, I can lift a 200-pound living, breathing human, for a few seconds anyway, but dragging 200 pounds of ungainly dead weight by the legs through the restaurant and down the stairs to the boucherie requires four strong men. The boucher, charcutier, dishwasher, and I wrestle the beast down the stairs, its head bouncing gruesomely on each step. I know now what it must be like to dispose of a body, I mutter. I do not envy the Gambino crime family. This is work. The general manager sits down to lunch with the hostess. Two calamari, no oil, no garlic, a fish special, no sauce, a celery remoulade. Frank, my new French sous chef, arrives. I have a list for him. Dinner specials, mise en place, things to do, things to look out for. When he takes over the sauté station later, relieving me, I am grateful. My knees are hurting, and the familiar pain in my feet is worse than usual. José, my boss, stops by wanting to take me to the green market. I quickly tie up a few loose ends, make sure Frank is briefed, and walk down to the market about 11 blocks. We fondle, sniff, squeeze, and rummage through produce for a while, returning to the restaurant an hour later with pears, lemon verbena, some baby fennel, fingerling potatoes, some turnips with greens, for all of which I'll have to come up with specials. The joke around Leal is that every time José walks in the door, the food cost climbs 2%. The man would have me mount all my sauces with Normandy butter and foie gras, garnish everything with fresh truffles if I didn't squawk. But he loves food, a good thing in an owner. José gets a dreamy look on his face when he hears about black truffles coming in a season or the first soft-shell crabs of the season, even at $60 a dozen, or anything seasonal, high-quality, classic French, gamey, or difficult to find. He wants to be the first to sell it, whatever it costs. It's a strategy that seems to be working. The backbone of the business may be steak-frites, but our regulars are often pleasantly surprised to find $15 worth of exotic food on a plate they're only paying $20 for, and little extras like that help develop a loyal clientele. Life with José means frequent surprise deliveries of very perishable and very expensive items, which I have to scramble to find outlets for. But what chef doesn't enjoy a load of Dover soles still dripping with channel water and twisted with rigor falling into his clutches? Okay, my grill man won't be too thrilled. He's the guy I'll have to skin and bone and reassemble in the order, but that's just tough. Back from the market, night crew suiting up in the locker room, I have just enough time to assemble the orders for Saturday. This is something I enjoy doing. My young gangster friend Segundo and I take a full tour of my walk-in and reach-ins. I've got two clipboards under my arm, one to assemble my orders, one page for Saturday, another to begin the Monday list, and a second for prep list, my things-to-do-tomorrow list. I break it down by company as I go along. DeBraga gets the Monday meat order, Schaller and Weber the bacon, Riviera and Ridge get the produce. I'm too embarrassed to talk to Baldor right now. I see I need 40 pounds of whitewater mussels, 30 pounds of squid, 8 whole fish, and a new fish of the day for Saturday and Sunday. I call Wild Edibles and talk to Chris Giragi, who was also a chef for Pinot at one point, and we discuss what's good for tomorrow. I go for some wild striped bass, some king salmon, and some baby octopus for appetizer special. Dry goods I'm locked in for the weekend. No Saturday deliveries, but I start building a Monday list anyway. From D'Artagnan, I'll need some more foie gras by Monday, some duck bones, maybe some magret, and maybe I'll splurge on some fresh black trumpets and some chanterelle for a special. José will be thrilled. And since Wild Boar has been a big moneymaker for me lately, maybe I'll make up on the boar what I lose on the shrooms. I add two boar legs to my D'Artagnan list. Segundo knows exactly what I'm going to ask him and in what order. He's ready for me. We go through the familiar list of items in my inept but still useful Spanish. Mezclan, pante, he replies. Cebolla blanca, una. Shallot, tres, and so on. Dairy has to be in earlier, they'll call me, which I hate. So I call the Monday dairy in right away. Two poly milks, four 55-pound blocks of sweet butter, one case of heavy cream ultra, a case of large eggs. Gourmand, another specialty purveyor, needs lead time. They ship out of Washington, D.C. So I get that order together as quickly as possible. Haricots de Tarbes, the expensive white beans we use for cassoulet, perfect absorption. Foie de brick for pastry, Provence honey for the duck sauce, white anchovies and olive oil for Niçoise salads, escargot, flageolet, and I'm already thinking about pot-au-feu for next week and will need plenty of the expensive gray sea salt for condiment. Ramon, the day dishwasher, tells me he'll need the day off tomorrow to visit a relative in the hospital, but he's replaced himself with Jaime number 2, the night dishwasher, who'll double for him. I'm grateful as nothing causes me more grief than last-minute emergency scheduling, and I'm always pleased when my crew takes care of things internally. Phoning my mafia at home is a near impossibility. Most of them claim to not own phones. For those who do, their phones are answered by people suspicious of strange North Americanos asking questions and are not likely to acknowledge that, yes, Mr. Perez Rodriguez Garcia Sanchez Rivera is actually in residence at said address. Dinner tasting for the floor staff is at 5:30, when the heavy-hitting veteran waiters have arrived. They fall on the family gruel and the tasting plates like rabid jackals. It's never pretty watching waiters eat. You'd think they had no money the way they dive into any available trough. Dinner tasting is conducted in the kitchen, as there are customers in the dining room straight through lunch into dinner. It looks like a crowded subway car as I describe the evening's specials and present each plate. They tear at the four plates of food, ripping apart the pheasant with their hands, nearly spearing each other with forks as they gouge at the tuna, drag cockles to their greasy maws with bare hands, and quickly turn Janine's lovely tartatin into a dark smear. I swallow some more aspirins. At 5:45, the downstairs is clogged with the nighttime lifer waiter crew sitting on milk crates, folding napkins, smoking, and talking about each other. Who got drunk last night? Who got thrown out of a mob run after-hours club, then woke up in the bushes outside their house? Who thinks the new maitre d' is going to lose it tonight when the room fills up and the customers stacked up at the bar start screaming for their tables? Who's going to win the World Cup? Who thinks Heather Graham is a babe? Who probably takes it in the ass this week? And how about the time the Bengali busboys got into a fight in the middle of the dining room and one stuck a steak knife into the other? Dinner service, overbooked as usual, with two whopping 12 tops booked for prime time. I remain in the kitchen to expedite, hoping that maybe, just maybe, things will slow down enough by 10 for me to have a couple of cocktails and get home by 11. But I know full well that the two big tables will hold up seatings by at least an hour. More than likely, I'll be here for the full tour. By 8:30, the board is full. Entree tickets flutter in the pull from the exhaust fans. To my right, below the window, plated appetizers are lined up, waiting to get delivered to the tables. The window is full of sauté dishes, and the work table in front of the fry station, a panorama of steaks of different dunnesses. It's still Cachondo. He's working a double two, and he furries the plates out by hand, four or five at a time. Still, I have to press gang the occasional busboy or empty-handed waiter, separating them out from the herd at the coffee and bread stations, and returning dirty plates and glasses into delivering desserts. I don't want ice cream melting over the clafouti or the whipped cream on the chocolate mousse to start falling. Food's getting cold, and my voice is already blown out from calling out orders over the noise from the dishwasher, the hum of the exhaust, the whine of the Paco jet machine, and the growing roar from the dining room. I make a hand gesture to a friendly waiter who knows what I want, and he soon arrives with an industrial, a beer stein filled with margarita for me. The drink manages to take the edge off my raging adrenaline buzz and goes down nicely after the three double espressos, two beers, three cranberry juices, eight aspirins, two ephedrine drinks, and a hastily gobbled hunk of merguez, which I manage to squeeze in a wajilla bread before swallowing it in two bites. By now my stomach is a roiling hell broth of suppressed frustration, nervous energy, caffeine, and alcohol. The night guard manger man, Angel, who looks like he's 12 but sports a tattoo of a skull impaled with a dagger on his chest, future wife beater, I think, is falling behind. He's got three raviolis, two duck confits, five green salads, two escargots, two Belgian endive Stilton salads, two cockles, a smoked salmon a blini, two foie gras and a pâté working, and the sauté and grill stations are calling for urgent vegetable sides and mashed potatoes. I swing the pastry commis over to Angel's station to help out, but there's so little room they just bump into each other, getting in each other's way. Tim, a veteran waiter, is dry-humping Cachondo, to Cachondo's apparent displeasure. He's blocking the lane and impeding traffic in the narrow kitchen with his thrusting. I have to ask Tim nicely not to sexually harass my runners during service. After work, please. An order comes back for refire, and Isidoro is not happy about it. It's cooked perfectly. I peer out into the dark dining room and see nothing except the dark silhouettes of customers waiting for tables at the bar. Hear even over the noise in the kitchen, the ambient chatter, the constant roar of diners as they shout over the music, the waiters describing specials over that noise, and fighting each other to get at the limited number of computer terminals to place orders, print out checks. Fire table 14, 14, that's 6, 7, 14, and 1 on fire, I shout. Isidoro, you time it. I ready 14, says Isidoro, the grill man, as he slaps the refire back on a plate. Cachondo reaches around me and loads up with food, picking out plates seemingly at random as if he's plucking daisies. I dry swallow some more aspirins and duck back into the stairwell for a few puffs of cigarette. A whole roasted fish comes back. The customer wants it deboned, says an apologetic waiter. I told him it comes on the bone, he whines, anticipating decapitation himself. Isidoro growls and works on the return fish, slipping off the fillets by hand, then replating it. The printer's going nonstop now. My left hand grabs tickets, separates out the white copy for grill, yellow copy for sauté, pink copy for me, coffee orders for the busboys. My right hand wipes plates, jams gaufret potatoes and rosemary sprigs into mashed potatoes, moves tickets from the order to the fire positions, appetizers on order to appetizers out. I'm yelling full time now, trying to hold it together, keep an even pace. My radar screen is filled with incoming bogeys, and I'm shooting them down as fast as I can. One mistake, where a whole table comes back because of a prematurely fired dupe, or a bad combination of special requests ties up a station for a few critical seconds, or a whole roasted fish or a cote de boeuf has been forgotten, the whole line could come grinding to a dead stop, like someone dropping a wrench into a GM assembly line. utter meltdown, what every chef fears most. If something like that happens, it could blow the whole pace of the evening, screw up everybody's heads, and create a deep, dark hole that could be very hard to climb out of. I got a hot nut for table six, I yell. There's a rapidly cooling boudin in the window, waiting for a tuna special to join it. 2 minutes, says Isidoro. Where's that fucking confit, I hiss at poor Angel, who's struggling valiantly to make blini for smoked salmon, brown ravioli under the salamander, lay out pâtés, and do 5 endive salads at once. A hot escargot explodes in the window, spattering me with boiling garlic butter and snail guts. Shit, I say, dabbing my eye with a side towel. Pinche escargot. Frank's doing very well, keeping up. He did his apprenticeship with Robuchon, making food somewhat more elegant and delicately arranged than our Leal humble working man's fare, so it's a nice surprise that he's turned out to be such a line stud, cheerfully cranking out simple brasserie chow with speed and efficiency. He doesn't over-rely on the salamander, which I like. A lot of his French predecessors insist on cooking everything stone rare, slicing, and then coloring the slices under the salamander, something I hate to see. He makes minimal use of the microwave, which the Cholo contingent has come to refer to contemptuously as cooking French style, and I've only seen him throw one steak in the fryer later. All in all, he's worked out well so far. Platos, screams Isidoro. The dishwasher is buried up to his shoulders in the pot sink, his pre-wash area stacked with plates of unscraped leftovers and haphazardly dumped silver. I snarl and grab a Bengali busboy, shove his snout into a plate heaped with gnawed bones and half-eaten vegetables. Scrape, I hiss, menacingly referring to the mess of unscraped plates. Busy chef, complains the busboy, who, from what I've seen, has been wandering around with his thumb up his ass, taking out the occasional coffee for hours. I don't give a fuck if you're saving the world, I say. Scrape the plates now, or I'll tear your booga off and hurl it across the street at Park Bistro. David, the Portuguese busboy, is making espressos and cappuccinos behind me, but he moves pretty gracefully back there, not bumping me or spilling. We're used to each other's movements in the narrow space we share, knowing when to move laterally, when to make way for incoming dishes, outgoing food, the fry guy returning from downstairs with another 100-pound load of freshly cut spuds. I feel only the occasional light tap on the shoulder as he squeezes through with another tray of coffee and petit four, maybe a whispered behind you or bajando. Fred and Ginger time. Finally, the printer starts slowing down, and I can see by the thinning crowd at the bar that the last seating is underway. White spaces opening up in the dining room, stripped tables waiting for customers. We've got 280 dinners under our belts already. I turn the expediting over to Cachondo, drag my ass down the Stairmaster for a final walkthrough. I check the stocks cooling in plastic buckets outside the walk-in, the gauze-wrapped pig's feet, which will have to be painstakingly deboned tomorrow, the soaking tarbay beans, which have to be blanched, the salt-rubbed duck legs, which will have to be confit in duck fat and herb, and I notice the produce that José and I bought earlier at the market. I make a final swing through the dry goods room, note that I'll be needing more peanut oil soon, more peppercorns, more sherry wine vinegar. I'm already working on an early draft of tomorrow's things-to-do list, tomorrow's order list. I've got striped bass already ordered and baby octopus, I remind myself. José's got a boner for Black Mission figs. He saw some at the market. So I'll have to tell Janine to start thinking about figs for a special. I'll have weekly inventory tomorrow morning, which means I'll have to weigh every scrap of meat and fish and cheese in the store and record it, count every can, bottle, case, and box. There will be payroll tomorrow, making sense of the punch-ins and punch-outs of my not-very-computer-wise cooks and porters and dishwashers, all 14 of them. And there's that extra shift for Carlos, who worked extra for me last week, and the extra half for Isidoro the night he covered Omar, and Omar doubled twice to cover the vacationing Angel, and shit, there's the overtime for that event at Beard House, and a promo party for, what was it, a Taste of NoHo, Burgundy Night, a benefit for Prickly Heat. I have to record all the transfers of food from my stores to our outposts, the smoked salmon I shipped off to Washington, the flageolet I sent to Miami, the rosette and jambon de Paris I sent to Tokyo. I have to record all the stuff I gave to the butcher counter up front, and Philippe, my other boss, wants a list of suggestions for specials for the Tokyo chef. I pull off my fetid whites, groaning like a 2,000-year-old man as I struggle into my jeans and pull over. I'm on my way out the door, but Isidoro wants to talk to me. My blood runs cold. When a cook wants to talk to you, it's seldom good news. Problem with another cook, minor feud, paycheck problem, request for time off. In Isidoro's case, he wants a raise. I gave Carlos a raise last week, so I'll have a rash of greedy line cooks jumping me for money for the next few weeks. Another note to self. Frank needs a 16th off, so I have to call Steven. I'm still buzzed with adrenaline when I finally push through the last waiting customers by the hostess stand and out the door and wave for a taxi. I'm thinking about going home, but I know I'll just lie there, grinding my teeth and smoking. I tell the cabbie to take me to the corner of 50th and Broadway, where I walk downstairs to the Subway Arcade and the Siberia Bar. A grungy little underground rumpus room where the drinks are served in plastic cups and the jukebox suits my taste. There are a few cookies from the Hilton at the bar, as well as a couple of saggy, bruised-looking strippers from a club up the street. Tracy, the owner of the joint, is there, which means I won't be paying for drinks tonight. It's 1 a.m., and I have to be in at 7:30 mañana. but the Cramps are playing on the jukebox. Tracy immediately fiddles with the machine so there's 20 free credits, and that first beer tastes mighty good. The Hilton cookies are arguing about mise en place. One of them is bitching about another cook nicking salt off his station, and the other cook doesn't see why that's such a big deal, so I'm going to be involved in this conversation. The Cramps tune is followed by the Velvet singing Pale Blue Eyes, and Tracy suggests a shot of Georgian vodka he's got stashed in the freezer. Sous chef. My sous chef, in an ideal situation, is like my wife. I'll go further. My sous chef in an ideal situation is closer to me than my wife. I mean no disrespect to my wife, Nancy, whom I adore and with whom I've been stealing horses since high school. It's just that I spend a lot more time with my sous chef. The judge, as Nancy likes to remind me, will never believe it. Stephen, my sous chef from 1993 until recently, when he finally took on a kitchen of his own, was my evil twin. My doppelganger, my director of clandestine services, a Bilko-esque character who, in addition to the usual sous chef responsibilities, such as running the kitchen in my absence, line cooking at a high level and watching my back, was invaluable to me for his remarkable ability to get things done. Key to the walk-in lost? Just ask Stephen. He'll have that door off its hinges in minutes. Robot coop needs a replacement part in the middle of a busy holiday rush? Stephen will slip out the door and be back in minutes with the part, slightly used and with another restaurant's shallot still in it. Want to know what they're thinking in the office? Ask Stephen. He's suborned the secretaries and is reading the interoffice email on a regular basis. Need bail money? A codeine pill for that knife wound? A new offset serrated knife real cheap? He's your boy. When I wonder what's in the heart and mind of someone I work with, I ask Stephen. He'll take them out, get them liquored up so they blab their guts out, and I'll have a full report by noon next. All the things I couldn't do or couldn't be seen to do, he did, and he did them well. In fact, though a highly paid executive chef now for a major corporate outfit, he still works for me one night a week on my grill station to keep his hand in, I guess. So there is still an action arm to my administration, a covert action arm. Having a sous chef with excellent cooking skills and a criminal mind is one of God's great gifts. In our glory days together, like the capo of a crime family or the director of the CIA, I could look across the room at Stephen, raise an eyebrow, maybe make an imperceptible movement with my chin, and the thing, whatever the thing was at the time, would be done. Espionage, impromptu collection of materiel, revenge, disinformation, and interrogation are specialties. I met Stephen at the supper club. It was 1993, my return to the bigs. I'd been working for Bigfoot at his West Village saloon, comfortable but in career limbo. I took a few weeks off to kick back in the Caribbean, and when I returned, I found a down-on-his-luck Jimmy Sears in Bigfoot's kitchen. Bigfoot had been eating dinner at the Gotham recently and had experienced some kind of culinary epiphany. Suddenly, he wanted a real chef, and Sears, whose restaurant in the Hamptons had just gone under, was sleeping on floors around Manhattan, dodging creditors and ex-girlfriends, and in general going through a rough patch, prime time for a Bigfoot recruiting effort. Jimmy was a brilliant cook. He'd come up with Brendan Walsh at Arizona 206, and the food he turned out in his brief time working the Bigfoot mines was so good, I'd stay after my shift was over, sit at the bar and order dinner, and pay for it. Seeing what Jimmy could do in the kitchen really inspired me. I'd been slinging hash for way too long, and tasting a real demi-glace again, eating new exciting food, seeing new presentations, made me remember what I'd enjoyed about food in the first place. I worked hard for Jimmy, and after knocking out a few thousand meals, going skiing together a few times, we'd become pals. And we determined that when Jimmy and Bigfoot's relationship came to an end, as it inevitably would, I'd keep an eye on the talented Mr. Sears, maybe come along for the ride when he made his next move. That clash of wills was not long in coming. A few months later, Jimmy's period of saloon exile was over. He landed the exec chef gig at the Supper Club, a huge restaurant nightclub disco on West 47th Street, and began hiring cooks. I was one of the first to get the call. It was a plum job to be executive chef at the Supper Club. Hell, it was a plum job doing anything at the Supper Club. Perk-odelic. The main dining room sat about 200, with private banquettes and booths along the walls, a dance floor and a stage from which a 12-piece orchestra played 40s swing music. There was an upstairs mezzanine, a holdover from the club's previous incarnation as a Broadway theater, which sat another 150 or so, with a second bar, and off to the side, also on the second floor, was a smaller venue, a cabaret-cum-VIP lounge called the Blue Room, which sat another 80. It was a pretty swank place, what they used to call a rug joint back in the 30s and 40s, a big, glitzy operation with plenty of cracks to fall through, a place where you could easily picture a young Burt Lancaster, just out of the joint, returning to find a young Kirk Douglas, the club owner, counting the night's take in one of the private banquettes. Dinner and dancing to swing music went from 5 to 11, after which the smoke machines would start belching chocolate-smelling fumes, the laser intellibeams would kick into action, the mirror ball would begin turning, a DJ would take over, and the supper club would become, for a while, the hottest dance club in town. Every night there was a different crowd with a different promoter. Chicks with Dicks Night featured towering transvestites and pre-ops tottering around on high heels to house and techno. Soul Kitchen featured pre-disco 70s funk, with early blaxploitation films playing silently on the big screen and 40-ouncers and chicken wings for sale. Giant Step had acid jazz and fusion. Café con Leche nights had salsa nueva and Latin funk. Funkmaster Flex attracted a hip-hop crowd. Noel Ashman attracted Eurotrash and the facelifted, well-dressed crowd. You never knew. There was every variety of nightlife madness, as each night people lined up down the street and around the corner on 8th Avenue, waiting to get past our metal detectors and our 13 burly security goons so they could rip up our bathrooms, crowd around our three bars, smoke weed, snort coke, and copulate like bunnies in every nook and cranny of our cavernous pleasure palace. Jimmy brought me in as an overpaid garde-manger man, 120 smacks a night to plate salads and squirt whipped cream on desserts. But Jimmy was not at that time an organizational mastermind. I am. Jimmy spent much of his time rollerblading around the city schmoozing. He had a second job cooking for Mariah Carey and Tommy Mottola. He was secretly working out a deal for his triumphant return to the Hamptons. And of course he was poking everything in his skirt. By the time he'd swing by the supper club, little things like ordering, scheduling, rotating food, and organizing menus were afterthoughts. I quickly found that doing it myself was easier than waiting for Jimmy to show up and do it for us. And in no time at all, I was running the nuts and bolts end of the kitchen, making sure that we had the food, the prep, the bodies, and information needed to crank out the enormous volume of parties, buffets, hors d'oeuvres, and regular menu items the business required. Jimmy's food, as always, was magnificent, but Jimmy himself seldom seemed to be around. After a few months, I was de facto sous chef or kitchen manager, the guy everyone came to find out what the hell was going on. And when I came back after another brief vacation in the Caribbean, Jimmy, though still nominally the chef, was secretly and simultaneously employed as the chef at the Inn at Quag out in the Hamptons, and Stephen Temple was working in the supper club kitchen. I guess it was a historic moment. He showed up looking for a sauté position, his even more degenerate friend, Adam, real last name unknown, in tow. I had a few weeks to watch these two in action before Sears slipped off to the Hamptons in his even more reduced summer schedule, and I begged, pleaded, and implored him not to saddle me with these two coke-snorting, thieving, fire-starting, whoring, boozing, and troublemaking miscreants. Jimmy ignored my entreaties. When Stephen and Adam were in the kitchen together, I couldn't turn my back for a second. They were hyperactive and destructive, two evil energizer bunnies who, when they weren't squabbling and throwing food at each other, seemed always to be dodging out of the kitchen on various criminal errands. They were loud, larcenous, relentlessly curious. Stephen can't look at a desk without rifling its contents. They played practical jokes and set up whole networks of like-minded co-workers. A few weeks after he arrived, Stephen already had the whole club wired from top to bottom. The office help would tell him what everyone else was getting paid. Security would give him a cut of whatever drugs they impounded at the door. And the techies let him play with the computers so that when an order for, say, swordfish came in, the dupe would also say, fuck me hard. Maintenance gave him a share of the lost and found and split the leftover booty from the promotional events, goodie bags filled with cosmetics, CDs, T-shirts, bomber jackets, wristwatches, etc. The chief of maintenance even gave Stephen the key to a disused office on the supper club's neglected third floor, an old janitor's storage room that, unbeknownst to management, had been converted to a carpeted, furnished, and fully decorated pleasure pit, complete with working phone. It was a space suitable for small gatherings, drug deals, and empire building. The room was decorated with posters of Latino women penetrating themselves with vegetables, and it had been done up with pilfered carpet remnants and furniture from the adjoining Edison Hotel. As the space was located up a long flight of garbage-strewn back stairs behind the reeking locker rooms down a dark, unlit hall where spare china was stored, management never visited, and a young man could be secure in the knowledge that whatever dark business he was conducting, no matter how loud, unruly, or felonious, he was unlikely to be disturbed. When management finally got wind of the fact that Jimmy was getting paid for not working at the supper club, I was made the chef. Unfortunately, Stephen had already carved out his own invisible empire within my own. It made things difficult. The boy could cook, though. The club, particularly during the winter party season when we regularly did banquets and sit-downs for hundreds and hundreds of people, required strength, skill, and endurance, and an ability to improvise fast of its cooks. The bulletin board on my office wall was clogged with party sheets. Sit-down meals for 300 would lead directly into four buffets and a cocktail reception for 700, often on the same day. The logistics involved in buying the food, preparing it, and moving it around for so many people were staggering. The invasion of Normandy every day of the week. Having an enterprising and capable little bastard like Stephen around was a powerful asset. He was a guy who could stay up all night snorting coke and drinking Long Island iced teas, getting into trouble of the most lurid kind, and still show up the next morning and knock out 1,000 meals. I may have spent way too much time investigating the criminal activities of the Stephen and Adam crime family, always calling one or the other into my office for a tune-up or an interrogation. I must have fired them both at least 3 times. But they, particularly Stephen, always found a way to weasel their way back into my good graces and make themselves invaluable. Stephen, for a while, it seems, saw the light, to whatever extent that's possible with Stephen. One night, Nancy and I bumped into him at a bar in West Hampton. He'd been moonlighting, typical of Stephen, for Sears, and when I saw him, he was slurring his words, his jaw twitching from cocaine, his eyes scrambling around in his sockets like caged spider monkeys. And he slapped an arm around my shoulders and announced that he was going to start showing up to work on time, that he was going to start behaving responsibly, that he was going to turn over a new leaf. I remember Nancy looking at me as if to say, yeah, right. He was, of course, promising much more than he could ever deliver. Life with Stephen over the last 5 or 6 years has been notable for one hideous outrage after another. But he did begin showing up at work on time. He stopped disappearing on 2- and 3-day benders. He tried as best he could to refrain from bringing shame and disgrace upon my house and kitchen. Most important, Stephen suddenly and inexplicably became the sort of person who, when he says he's going to do a thing, does it. This, more than anything else, is the essence of sous chefdom. With Stephen around, I no longer had to come in the morning and say, did you take care of that thing? The thing was always taken care of. I like that. I made him my sous chef. Let's revisit, reconstructing from an untrustworthy and incomplete record, the checkered career of Stephen Temple. He grew up on Long Island, attended Johnson & Wales Culinary School, where unsurprisingly he ran into trouble, something about an assault, and was nearly expelled. He worked in a diner in Providence while he was at J&W. Stephen, for all his faults, likes money and was never afraid to work. Did time at Big Barry's out on the island, bounced around a progression of knucklehead jobs, and eventually migrated to Northern California, ending up at a joint called La Casa Nostra, where he encountered the uncontrollable idiot savant and baking genius Adam, real last name unknown. Nobody knows as far as the government is concerned. He doesn't even exist. Like Hunt and Liddy, these are two guys who should never have been allowed in a room together. When they're together, a sort of supernova of stupidity occurs, a critical mass of bad behavior. They like to reminisce about this California idol period of their lives, snorting coke through uncooked penne, projectile vomiting in the parking lots of strip clubs, driving their owner into insolvency, soliciting, pandering, stealing, and in every way leaving a trail of destruction and bodily fluids in their wake. Stephen returned to New York, probably one step ahead of the law, and worked brief stints at Matthews with Matthew Kenny, asshole, says Stephen, Carmine's, the Plaza Hotel, and some other very decent restaurants for brief periods of time. Along the way, he managed to pick up a very respectable set of line cooking chops, as well as that peculiar variety of less legitimate skills that continue to serve him well to this day. He remains a remarkable font of knowledge about the inner workings of the restaurant business, the real cogs and wheels. He can fix a broken compressor, repair appliances, pick locks, jury-rig electrical power where there was none before, unclog a grease trap, find a breaker, fix a refrigerator door. And he is a close observer of every detail of human and mechanical activity in the workplace, a guy who notices things, probably a result of all those years looking for opportunities for criminality. Little gets by him. If somebody's running a scam, Stephen knows all about it. The idea, more than likely, occurred to him first. As we battled through party season at the supper club, Stephen and I did a lot of after-work drinking together, sitting around reviewing the events of the evening, planning our moves for the next day, pondering the mysteries of this life we live. I came to rely on him more and more, to find out what was going on, to fix things, to help me in the crushing, relentless routine of serving hundreds and hundreds of meals, different menus every day, hors d'oeuvre, a la carte meals, managing a staff of cooks that would swell into double digits for big events, then shrink back to a core group of about 8 for regular service. Buying $10,000 worth of meat a day gave me a strange and terrible thrill, like riding a roller coaster, and the simple act of moving ceiling-high piles of perishable fish and produce through my kitchen every day was a puzzle, a challenge I enjoyed. I liked being a general again, deploying forces where needed, sending out flying squads of cooks to put out brush fires on the buffet stations, arranging reconnaissance, forward observers, communicating by walkie-talkie with the various corners of the club. More filet on buffet 6 would come the call. More salmon on buffet 4. This is security at the door. I got a body count of 300 and climbing. They're really coming in. Amusingly, we shared a radio band with a nearby undercover unit from the street crime division of the NYPD. They were always trying to get us to change frequency, which we couldn't, as we used them all, one for managers, one for kitchen, and a security band. After threats and shouts didn't work, the cops got clever. They listened, got to know our lingo and our locations, and would play games with us, calling for more roast beef on buffet 1 when none was needed, or creating notional emergencies that would cause security to gang rush the mez bathroom to break up a non-existent fight. It was a wild style life. It wasn't unusual to see naked women hosing ice cream off their bodies in the kitchen pot sink, the Howard Stern event. Sinister Moroccan food tasters packing heat, Royal Air Maroc party. Ted Kennedy in a kitchen walkthrough eerily reminiscent of RFK's last moments. Our drunken crew in a hostile mood bullying a lost Mike Myers into doing that Wayne's World excellent thing. Rosie Perez hanging on the sauté end, fitting right in as if she worked with us, sitting on a cutting board. What's good to eat in here, boys? A clip piercing on stage, Stern again. Madonna fans trying to sneak through the kitchen from the hotel. She brings her own eggs for Caesar salad. Concerts, swimsuit models, hardcore hip-hoppers, go-go boys. One day there'd be a wedding for 100 people where the customers spent $1,000 per person for lobster and truffle ravioli, individual bottles of vodka frozen in blocks of ice, baby wedding cakes for every table, and the next the whole club would be tented over, filled with dervishes and dancers from North Africa, serving couscous and pigeon pie for 1,000. Thanks to the Bigfoot program, I never ran out of food, was always prepared, was never late. And Stephen helped enormously. What finally made him a serious character in my eyes was the night he ran a knife through his hand while trying to hack frozen demi-glace out of a bucket. Squirting blood all over the place, he wrapped his hand in an apron and listened to my instructions. Get your sorry ass down to St. Vincent's. They've got a fast emergency room. Get yourself stitched up and get yourself back here in 2 fucking hours. We're going to be busy as hell tonight, and I need you on the line. He returned 90 minutes later and managed to work one-handed on the sauté station, very capably cranking out 150 or so a la carte dinners. I was pleased with this demonstration of loyalty. Working through pain and injury counts for a lot with me. I don't really know what happened to the supper club. The general manager, with whom I had a good working relationship, was suddenly gone. Nightclub operations were shut down, possibly in response to neighborhood complaints about noise, unmanageable crowds in the streets, change in ownership. The new management team was an oily duo of ex-waiters from the Waldorf, a Spaniard and an I-don't-know, who liked to pretend they were French. I answered an ad in the paper for a chef and was quickly in the wind. I took Stephen along. One look at 1-5 and I knew the place was doomed. Jerry Kretschmer, with the hugely talented Alfred Portali in tow, had just failed in the same location. The new owners were two very nice, matronly, middle-aged ladies with little to no restaurant experience. But I fell in love with the kitchen. It was huge, well-equipped, and loaded with history. I'd even worked there for a day while at CIA as part of a day in New York field trip. The dining room was appointed with the salvage from the ocean liner Normandy, which had sunk mysteriously in New York Harbor. It was an irresistible impulse. My predecessor, a jumped-up megalomaniacal boob, had already plowed through most of the partner's dough, insisting on a kitchen staff of 13 people to serve 60 or so dinners a night. So I figured it wouldn't be too hard to make a difference and do some honest toil for these nice ladies, save them a few bucks. Hiring crew post-supper club with Stephen as my underboss was always fun. I felt like Lee Marvin with Stephen as Ernest Borgnine in The Dirty Dozen when they recruit a fighting unit from the dregs of the stockade. Stephen and I would meet, and I'd say, who's available? We'd discuss who was still talking to himself, suffering from paranoid delusions, but can he still work the line? Who could be lured away from another job? Is he happy? How happy? What's he getting paid? Who was still loyal from the collection of part-timers and freelancers we'd use for party work at the supper club? Who had evenings free after knocking off at Le Bernardin? Who could keep it together, show up on time, keep their mouth shut and do the right thing, even if he woke up every morning naked and covered with puke on a cold bathroom floor? Stephen would scour the lunatic fringe, other chefs' kitchens, flipping through the amazing mental Rolodex he kept in his head, the two of us embarking again on a clandestine headhunt that often stripped rival kitchens bare. I loved those first interviews, laying eyes on old friends, new recruits, a motley collection of psychopathic grill men, alcoholic garde-manger men, trash-talking chick sauciers, Ecuadorian pasta cooks, deranged pâtissiers, cooks who thought that Sylvester Stallone was keeping them under constant surveillance. "Sly knows I wrote Cliffhanger, and he knows I know too much," said one cook who'd apparently been communicating telepathically with Stallone while flipping burgers at Planet Hollywood. "I need a 2 Heineken, 7 o'clock, said my old friend Chinese Davy from Bigfoot days, his hand scraped raw from extracting bottles of beer from a chain cooler night after night. "Every night, 7 o'clock, 2 Heineken, no Budwasser, Heineken." He got the job. "I am there, chef," said Manuel, a pasta stud on the phone from a very busy midtown kitchen. "I am with you." He dropped his apron in the middle of pre-theater rush, told the chef to fuck himself, and rushed right over. Always liked that guy. He needed Sundays off to go to church, he said. No problem. And God help me, I even hired Adam. Now and again. "I'm never going to slink home again knowing I fucked up," I tell Stephen in one of our many post-game analysis sessions. "Things go sour here, it won't be for lack of trying on my part. I ain't never going to dog it. I'm never going home at the end of the shift feeling ashamed. I don't care if the crackpots we work for deserve it or not. We're going to give 100%. We're going to fight Dien Bien Phu over and over again every night. I don't care if we lose the war. We are professionals, man. We're the motherfucking A-team, the pros from Dover, cool breeze, and ain't nobody ever going to say we dropped the ball, let the side down, let things slide." 1-5 tanked. The entertainment didn't help. We featured musical attractions so pathetic it would have made Joe Franklin blush. One-armed piano players, octogenarian cabaret singers, aspiring Broadway ingenues whose nasal-inflected warbling could shatter glass, haplessly incompetent yodelers. Customers would wander through our magnificent revolving doors, clap eyes on one of these creatures belting out New York, New York with a Yugoslavian accent, and turn on their heels and run. Like a lot of restaurants in trouble, we got shaken down by every sleazebag publicist. "I got Joey Buttafuoco to come in tonight. Make sure to comp him." And corrupt gossip columnist, "My husband is at loose ends tonight. Can you take care of him?" The press we got from such largesse usually amounted to something like, "Seen canoodling at 1-5, John Wayne Bobbitt and Joey Buttafuoco," not a mention likely to inspire a gang rush of dining public. But Stephen and I were happy. We had the cooks we wanted. We were making nice food. When I was hired by Pino Longo to open up Coco Pazzo Teatro, my brief Tuscan interlude, I took Stephen along, and after that, Sullivan's. We were a traveling roadshow, and we moved to another kitchen where we peeled the best of the cooks we'd left behind with us. Stephen, as I said, is my kind of sous chef. He loves cooking, and he loves cooks. He doesn't yearn for a better, different life than the one he has, because he knows he's got a home in this one. He gets along with just about anyone at any time. Total strangers tending to forgive him his most egregious excesses, whatever he says or does. He's an ingratiating bastard, totally without pretense, and you cannot embarrass, shame, or insult him. He knows how bad he is. The Mexican line cooks at Leal love him, and his tortured, completely useless command of kitchen Spanish amuses the hell out of him, as do his habits of singing Elton John and Madonna tunes in a high-pitched, atonal voice, prancing shamelessly around the kitchen like some spastic breakdancer, taping over his sensitive nipples with Band-Aids, to avoid chafe, he insists, powdering his balls on the line with cornstarch, and showing anyone who's interested his latest cold sore, the boil on his ass, an incipient zit. He truly loves the technical aspects of cooking, works fast, clean, and makes pretty plates. He likes to step into other stations when other cooks get in the weeds, chiding them in his horrible Spanish. He loves dishwashing when not busy on his station, finds no task too low or too demeaning to take an interest and help. He's a remarkably thoughtful guy. Mention you like gummy bears and Stephen will show up the next day with a bag. If he stops off at a burger stand for a mayo and mustard and ketchup slathered grease burger for breakfast, he'll bring a couple extra so everyone can have some. Alone among cooks I've met, he actually enjoys cooking for the floor staff, insisting on making them food that's actually edible. He jokes around with the waiters, managers, flirts with any woman, no matter her age, rank, background, and amazingly, they seem to like it. Mexican cooks I worked with for a year without hearing them peep a single word in English or Spanish were chattering happily away with Stephen after only a few hours of meeting him. Chuletita loca, they call him. Crazy little pork chop. He has a tattoo of a cartoon cat wearing a chef's toque on his crotch, and he's all too ready to drop his pants should you express interest in seeing it. In hot months, he works in sandals, no socks, the cuffs of his checks rolled up like clam diggers, a daring fashion statement in a kitchen where a dropped knife or spilled duck fat can be a career ender. He wears, with defiantly prole pride, a dishwasher's snap-front short-sleeved shirt, shunning the traditional chef's jacket. He refuses to wear an apron. He eats his meals smashed together in bite-sized chunks, meat, starch, and vegetable mixed into an ugly but apparently edible slurry, and he's always trying out new flavor combinations. Middle of the rush, Stephen is holding down his end brilliantly and somehow making little potato crisp and caviar snackies for the other cooks to try. There's always enough to go around. Bartenders, waiters, managers, cooks, dishwashers, porters tell him everything. Somehow he induces, without even trying, total strangers to tell him their most shameful and intimate secrets. They'll do anything for him, putting up cheerfully with his practical joking, his groping, his annoying practice of trying to throw pity pois into their ears, his horribly frank anecdotes about the previous evening's sexual adventures. I learned never to try to compete with Stephen in the practical joke department. He'll make a life's work out of getting you back. Leave a potato in his shoes and he'll freeze your street clothes. Put a sticker on his back, he'll take your locker door off the hinges and stack it full of porno magazines. On his birthday, I once arranged for him to receive a free trial pair of adult diapers. The next day, all the cooks were waiting for his reaction. He thanked me sincerely. You know, those things are pretty cool. I sat around the couch eating nachos and watching TV in my diaper, and it was great. I didn't even have to get up to go to the bathroom. It was great, and you know, it feels kind of neat. Our clean-living, deeply religious Ecuadorian pasta man at Sullivan's, Manuel, would receive 4 a.m. phone calls every night for weeks. Stephen, mid-coitus with his girlfriend. Manuel, grunt, plorp, it's Stephen, grunt, guess what I'm doing? And like everyone else in Stephen's life, Manuel played along. Oh, Jeff, he'd say, shaking his head the next day. Chula Tita called me again last night. Then he'd burst into giggles. I don't get it, still. If I did half the things that Stephen does regularly, and I'm not even talking about the felonies, just the brutish misbehavior, the bad taste, the remarks, the exhibitionism, the conniving, I'd end up in court defending myself against a host of sexual harassment lawsuits. And yet I can't think of anyone, except the owner of Sullivan's, but that's another story, who doesn't like Stephen, who doesn't find him adorable, who doesn't confide in him, go to him when they're confused or in trouble. An amazing accomplishment for a guy who shows up to work with sperm on his shoes. Stopped at a peep booth to toss off, he explains casually. Hey, I was horny. Who behaves like an utter pig at times, freely discusses his every digestive, dermatological, and sexual manifestation with anyone within hearing. And this, dear reader, is my closest and most trusted friend and associate. The level of discourse. There was a lull in service the other night, one of those all-too-brief periods of about 10 minutes, when the floor staff is busy trying to turn tables, and even though the bar is packed 3 deep with waiting customers and there's a line out the door, the kitchen is quiet. While busboys stripped and reset tables outside the kitchen door, the cooks, runners, and sous chefs swilled bottled water, wiped down their stations, and bullshitted. I stood in the doorway to the cellar prep kitchen and smoked a cigarette nervously. We were in that eerie eye-of-the-hurricane calm. In 10 minutes, when the next wave of hungry public had been seated and breaded and watered, there'd be a punishing rush, the slide filling up with orders all at once, the action swinging from station to station, boiling up the line like a Drano enema. First the salad guy would get hit, then the sauté station, and finally the grill, until everything came down at once, the whole bunch of us in the cramped kitchen struggling and sweating and cursing to move orders out without falling in the weeds. We had only a few moments of peace to go, and I smoked and fidgeted and half-listened to what my crew was talking about. The tone of the repartee was familiar, as was the subject matter, a strangely comfortable background music to most of my waking hours over the last 2 decades or so, and I realized that, my God, I've been listening to the same conversation for 25 years. Who's the bigger homo? Who takes it in the ass? Who exactly, at this particular moment, is a pede, a maricón, a fenocchio, a puta, a pato? It's all about dick, you see. It's chupa mis huevos time. Time for mama la pinga. Take it in your culo time, motherfucker, you pinche baboso crying little woman. And your bierga, it looks like a fucking half-order of merguez. Weem, weem, wee chica, like an insecto. This is the real international language of cuisine, I realized. Watching my French sous chef, American pâtissier, Mexican grill salad and fry guy exchange playful insults with the Bengali runner and the Dominican dishwasher. It's been, for 25 years, one long, never-ending game of the dozens played out in four or five languages. As an art form, cooktalk is, like haiku or kabuki, defined by established rules with a rigid, traditional framework in which one may operate. All comments must, out of historical necessity, concern involuntary rectal penetration, penis size, physical flaws, or annoying mannerisms or defects. The rules can be confusing. Cabron, for instance, which translates roughly to your wife, girlfriend is getting fucked by another guy right now and you're too much of a pussy to do anything about it, can also mean my brother, depending on inflection and tone. The word fuck is used principally as a comma. Suck my dick means hang on a second or could you please wait a moment? And get your shit together with your fucking me's or I come back there and fuck you in the culo means pardon me, comrade, but I am concerned with your state of readiness for the coming rush. Is your mise en place properly restocked, my brother? Pinche way means fucking guy, but can also mean you adorable scamp or pal. But if you use the word pal, or worse, my friend in my kitchen, it'll make people paranoid. My friend, famously, means asshole in the worst and most sincere sense of that word. And start being too nice to a cook on the line, and he might think he's getting canned tomorrow. My vato locos are, like most line cooks, practitioners of that centuries-old oral tradition in which we, all of us, try to find new and amusing ways to talk about dick. Homophobic, you say? Submental? Insensitive to gender preference and the gorgeous mosaic of an ethnically diverse workforce? Gee, you might be right. Does a locker room environment like this make it tougher for women, for instance? Yup. Most women, sadly. But what the system seeks, what it requires, is someone, anyone, who can hold up their station, play the game without getting bent out of shape and taking things personally. If you are easily offended by direct aspersions on your lineage, the circumstances of your birth, your sexuality, your appearance, the mention of your parents possibly commingling with livestock, then the world of professional cooking is not for you. But let's say you do suck dick, you do take it in the twins. It's no impediment to survival. No one really cares about that. We are too busy and too close and we spend too much time together as an extended dysfunctional family to care about sex, gender preference, race, or national origin. After level of skills, it's how sensitive you are to criticism and perceived insult and how well you can give it right back that determines your place in the food chain. You can cover your ears all you want. Pretend they're not calling you Chino or Morena or Indio or Gordo or Cachondo, but they are. Like it or not, that's your name, your street tag, whether you chose it or not. I've been Flaco and Cadavro, probably Borracho. That's just the way it is. I call down to my prep kitchen on the intercom, calling for butter or more sauce, and that little gangster who keeps my stock rotated and makes that lovely chiffonaded parsley for me is going to reply, after I'm out of hearing, "Fuck you!" before giving me exactly what I asked for. Better I say it first. Give me my fucking mantequilla and sauce, motherfucker, orita, and fuck you. And I love that little thug, too. The headband sporting, baggy pants, top button, bottom button open, moon boot shot, half Puerto Rican, half Cholo Vato Loco, with his crude prison-style tats and his butterfly knife tucked in his waistband. I have on many occasions pondered adopting him. He's everything I'd want in a son. Why do I, a fairly educated sort of a swine, take such unseemly pleasure in the guttural utterances of my largely uneducated, foul-mouthed crews? Why, over the years, have my own language skills become so crude and offensive that at family Christmas I have to struggle to not say pass the fucking turkey, cocksucker? I don't know, but I do love it. I wallow in it, just like all the other sounds of my life, the hiss and clatter and spray of the dishwasher, the sizzle as a fillet of fish hits a hot pan, the loud yelping noise, almost a shriek, as a glowing sizzle platter is dropped into a full pot sink, the pounding of the meat mallet on a cote de boeuf, the smack as finished plates hit the window. The goads, curses, insults, and taunts of my wildly profane crew were like poetry to me, beautiful at times. Each tiny variation on a classic theme like some beat-era jazz riff. Coltrane doing my favorite things over and over again, but making it new and different each time. There are, it turns out, a million ways to say suck my dick. Most of the people in my kitchen can do it in Spanish, French, Italian, Arabic, Bengali, and English. Like all great performances, it's about timing, tone, and delivery, kind of like cooking. There are also the terms of the trade, the jargon. Every trade has one. You already know some of our terms. 86 is the best known. A dish is 86 when there's no more. But you can use the term for somebody who's just been fired or about to be fired, or for a bar customer who's no longer welcome. One doesn't refer to a table of six or a table of eight. It's a six-top or an eight-top. Two customers at a table are simply a deuce. Weeded means in the weeds, behind, in the shit, or dans la merde. A close cousin and possible outcome of being slammed, buried, or hit. A waitron or waitron unit is an old-school 70s term, gender non-specific, for floor personnel who are also at staff mealtime referred to as the floor, or the family, or simply scum. And the meal itself becomes, particularly if it's a usual